From Hospice UK and Dying Matters, this is the Dying Matters podcast. I'm your host, Eleanor McConnell. Have you ever been to a really good funeral? It's a pretty weird question, I know, and if your response is that there's no such thing, to be honest, I can't really argue with you. I've been to funerals that felt utterly miserable at the time, where all you can think about is the person who's gone and how unfair it feels. But I have also helped to plan a funeral as an adult when my grandmother died. My parents, my brother and I all got together after her death to plan, talking not just about what she would have wanted from a funeral, but also practical issues. My grandmother died in Devon, which had its fair share of logistical nightmares, not least of which was that we had to think about how guests would be coming from far away, with a journey time of at least 8 hours there and back. So we had to think about how to accommodate them, and then what those guests wanted from her funeral, whether they wanted to contribute or say anything themselves. All this stuff can be a real nightmare if you're grieving, but I found it comforting to plan. In the end, we had an extremely bespoke and personal service, which my mum led, that somehow managed to acknowledge the complex layers of my grandmother's life. Although there were sad bits of the day, overall, it felt like an incredibly valuable process for us to go through as a family. But all this was made easier by the fact that my granny's funeral came at the end of a long life. She was in her 90s and had a good run, but obviously it doesn't always work out that way. My first guest this week, Jane Harris, was faced with the nightmare prospect of organising a funeral for her son, Josh, who died aged 22 in a road accident in Vietnam. In this episode, I talked to Jane about that experience, and how she was able to use filmmaking as a way to make something positive out of a terrible situation. Jane now runs the Good Grief Project with her husband Jimmy, in which they share their experience of grief through filmmaking. Their most recent film, A Love That Never Dies, is coming to cinemas this May, but it all began with the film that they made documenting the process of Josh's funeral.
So we soon realised that Josh's friends didn't know what to do about the death of their friend. We didn't know what to do, but we thought, let's all get together. Let's all try and work together to give Josh a really good send-off. And our first project around his death was making a film about his funeral called Beyond Goodbye.
Yeah, so that was an objective from the start to make the film and explore.
We started by making a film about his funeral, but we didn't know it was going to grow into a feature film in a mainstream cinema in Leicester Square in London. But when we made the film about Josh's funeral, in a way we were doing it for ourselves, to help ourselves. But what we learned very quickly was that Josh's friends didn't want to take part to begin with, until we said to them, we need you, we want you, Josh would want you to be part of this. And they were terrified of crying, they were terrified of showing their feelings,
really?
Because they've grown up in this culture where grief is such a mystery, bereavement is puzzling,
yeah.
People don't know how to talk about it or share it. And so we said, please come, please cry, please laugh, just be there, do your thing. And my goodness, did they do their thing. We laughed. I mean, some of the photographs at his celebration of life are of people laughing, of people crying. But what those young people brought, and they were 22 at the time, was they brought love, they brought memories. We got to know so much about Josh through them, and they got to know a lot about Josh through us.
Yeah.
But the whole day, they told me, helped them to realise that death is part of life. And they went away, some of them, saying to us, we're so glad we took part, we're so glad we sang our songs, we told our stories. And we actually, for the first time, have realised that life isn't forever and we're not immortal. And in a way, I felt sad about that because I'd like them not to know that. You know, it's like my daughter, you know, she was 18 when Josh died.
Yeah.
And at the time she said, well, I feel so much older than all my friends now, Mum. And I said, well, I suppose that's what death does. It cuts you. It sort of brings you up short and it makes you realise that you are time limited in some ways.
Makes you so aware.
Exactly.
I saw that you decided not to have a funeral director or a celebrant. You take me through that decision making process and why that was.
Yes. So Josh died traveling and we never got to say goodbye to him. And we were in shock. You know, we'd never organised a funeral before. We didn't know what to do. And we realised that there's one thing you do have to do after someone dies is you do have to have a funeral. But we didn't know what that meant. But we had a bit of a uncomfortable feeling around funerals that we'd been part of. And as we sat around the kitchen table, because in the early days when Josh died, we didn't go anywhere. We huddled together as a family. We were cold. We were lost. We were dark. We huddled together. We couldn't be apart because we were traumatized. And we talked about this funeral. And it began to dawn on us that we were going to have to do it ourselves. There were certain things that we needed to have done. And there was an amazing local celebrant who helped us out, you know, because we had to get Josh back from Vietnam. There were so many things, repatriation, so many awful things that I almost can't go into. You know, what clothes does someone wear in their coffin? It's almost unspeakable.
Mm-hmm.
No mother should have to choose their child's clothes.
No.
It's unthinkable, yet through the generations, mothers have been doing that. But when it happens to you, you think, no. It's not possible, I can't be doing this. So Jimmy at one point said, we're going to build Josh's coffin. And we all went, what? What's the matter with you? You know, we've got enough on our plate. So he gathered together our amazing community and they all went off and they built this coffin. And in a way, things grew from there. It was made with love. It was made beautifully. And then there was an idea that if we put doweling along the side of the coffin, people could tie ribbons on that. And that we could keep those ribbons after the funeral, after the cremation, because we decided on a cremation, that the body and the coffin were gone, these ribbons would remain. And we have beautiful hundreds of ribbons that we now have. It's like a sort of sculpture. It's beautiful.
Mm.
But the idea was, I suppose, in doing it ourselves, was that we could all say goodbye. It was really important to us to say goodbye. And we wanted Josh's friends to be involved. We needed them and they needed us. You know, it really mattered to us that they were part of it. And the more we explored it, the more energy we found, even though we thought it was impossible. We set this thing up that was just beyond belief. At a time when you think you can't function, this whole event materialised. Now, it's not to say everyone can do that, because I know lots of people can't.
Mm.
But we found a local venue, a beautiful place called the Matara Centre, and we had the funeral there, the celebration of his life. We spread it over a day. We wanted people to touch the coffin. We wanted Josh to be in the middle of the room. We wanted people to talk to him. And people went up and did touch it. It was very hands-on. And that gave us a great deal of strength.
Mm.
And throughout that day, there was something about it that gave us a lot of strength. We felt very held by the people around us, because we soon realised that funerals are for the living as much as for the dead. The dead. And we hadn't really thought about that. But that day lives on. And fortunately, because we made a film, the film lives on. And thousands of people have watched that film, which is staggering when you think about it, that people take an interest. Part of me didn't want to share it. Jimmy didn't want to share it, but we did it because we wanted to open up those most private, most primal, most awful experiences and make something positive of it.
Yeah.
And of course, some people at the funeral thought that was really awful to film at your funeral. But actually, we weren't really listening to that.
Yeah.
We told people we were going to be filming if people didn't want to.
So not everyone understood.
No, of course not. I mean, I just don't think, how can people? They think it's bizarre or voyeuristic. But then we've always filmed the difficult chapters in our lives.
Yeah.
Because film is a language. It has a language that can be shared and that can change things. And also we were learning an awful lot. So we had a celebrant there and we had an undertaker who brought a really lovely man called James Showers, who brought Josh's body there in an ordinary car. The celebrant helped us through, but she didn't know what we were trying to do. She kept saying, I'm not sure I get this. But on the day she said, I've got it.
Yeah.
She listened. She had to work so hard. But she got it, and she
just facilitated it for her.
Yeah. And I know she talks about it a lot, and I know that she, like us, like everyone, learns a lot from it.
Mm.
But it's a bit like the film in a West End cinema. When I think about it now, I think, how did we do that? I'm so glad we did, but how did we manage that? And I know that ritual has been really helpful for us. So that ritual of his funeral has helped us survive his death. And it's helped a lot of other people survive his death. His friends look back on that day and say, one young man who was one of Josh's best friends said, that day changed his life. He said the day changed his life because he suddenly realised that people die, 22-year-olds die.
Yeah.
And that's not normal thinking for a 22-year-old. But he also said that, yes, it was tragic, but it was also hopeful that he'd realised that, you know, he had a life and he was going to live it. He also said, I'm going to stop drinking from tomorrow and never drink again. Well, of course, we don't even...
yeah.
He didn't stick to that, but, you know, the intent was there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what was it about, I guess, more traditional funerals that didn't seem right for you or that made you uncomfortable?
I couldn't get over the idea that we were... I mean, we went to speak to people and we were shown all these expensive coffins. And,
yeah.
And I just... It really jangled me and Rosa and Jimmy and Joe. And there was a lot of talk about what sort of car we wanted, what sort of hair. And we said, no, actually, we don't want any of that. I find it quite alienating. Mm. The cost was huge if you went down certain routes. We decided to ask everyone to bring a flower. We decided to supply ribbons. We had flowers there and everyone could pick up a flower and put it on the coffin. Everyone was given a ribbon. They could write a message. People brought cakes that they'd made. It was a real budget. It was a real budget funeral. But actually, when you watch the film, it looks like the most deluxe funeral in the world because everyone poured their hearts into it.
Yeah.
Just fairy lights, photographs. We showed films, which we could do because we had films. But Rosa, our daughter, said that, you know, she had a horror of standing on a hillside on a rainy day with people in black coats. And she said, I couldn't do that, Mum. And I said, well, we're not going to. And she said, no, I know we're not. It's not our style, is it? But there was a sense of we wanted it to be bright and hopeful. Mm. And we wanted it to capture some of Josh's personality and the mood of his life and his friends. His best childhood friend wrote a song and she sang it. And the lyrics are beautiful.
So was it that all the options presented didn't seem personal enough to what you wanted?
Yes. So personalising it was a very big part of it. And I think things have changed in the last 7 years, of course. Things are improving. And, you know, a lot of people are personalising. A lot of people realise that you don't have to do certain things. That you know, it doesn't have to be this complicated. But I have also found that it's the people with the least resources who also feel they have to spend the most on funerals, and that seems unfair. But I think that's a complicated subject.
But no, I think the message is you can do whatever feels right, and to have the freedom of knowing that this is just as much for you as it is for the person who's died.
Exactly. And I think that that's what we realised. We thought when Josh died, there would be a rule book. We'd know what to do. Someone would tell us. And then we thought, we don't like that rule book. And what they're telling us is, buy this, buy that, honour your child by spending X number of pounds. And we thought, no, no, no. And so within a week, we realised there were no rules, actually. The rule that we applied was, if it feels right for us, we're going to do it. And if we're doing something wrong, someone's going to tell us that it's against the law or whatever, you know. But it was very personal. Mm. And it was so special. And I remember standing in front of hundreds of people on the day of his funeral thinking, God, this is amazing. All those people are here because they love Josh and we love Josh. And it's been a kind of organic process. And we're all sat round, sharing stories and sharing memories. And laughing and crying safely, without feeling ashamed. And it was very multicultural. Someone sang a Jewish prayer. There was others. I mean, there was no kind of particular religious affiliation, but everyone had a space.
Yeah.
There was no one who wasn't able to find their space. And that really helped us in our grieving journey. And I think Josh would have liked it.
Yeah.
I think Josh would have thought, yeah, that's a bloody good send-off my mum's given me, my mum and dad and family. I think he would have loved it. And that for us meant a lot. An awful lot.
Yeah. Would you have changed anything about the day now?
That's a good question. I'm relieved to say no.
Yeah.
That's a surprise to me. No, I wouldn't. The only thing I'd change is that I wish I hadn't had to. I just wish we hadn't had to have a funeral for our son, but I wouldn't have changed a thing about that day. And it lives on in my heart as a really positive memory. And that surprises me a lot.
Since making their first film, Jane and Jimmy have continued to channel their grief into a creative outlet, which they hope will help other people talk about and express their grief. I talked to Jane about their upcoming film, A Love That Never Dies, which documents the couple's journey across the USA and Mexico, talking to other parents who have lost a child.
So we make films, and we share stories, because we feel that that's how you help people to find a voice. And we had a dream. I remember at a Dying Matters event quite some years ago when I was presenting about my father's death. He had a terrible end of life with dementia. You know, there was no home that would take him because he was really complicated and quite aggressive. So he ended up in a specialist psychiatric unit for dementia patients.
Yeah.
And he had a terrible death. And I had this dream of good palliative care. And I know it's out there. And in fact, I dream of it. I'm such a fan of the idea. But my dad didn't get that.
Mm.
And I remember thinking at the time, I'm going to make a film about this because I don't know what else to do. I felt so helpless. So we made a film about his end of life. And in the same way, we're making a film about our grief experiences and other people's grief experiences. But I think what I've learned in the last 7 years is that it needs to be out there in the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be out there in big cinemas. And at that Dying Matters event, at the end of the event, we were asked to write down our aspirations and our dreams. And I wrote on a postcard, I want to make a film and I want to get it in a West End cinema. And I remember thinking, you dream on. That is so ridiculous. You're really kidding yourself. Have you got some sort of problem, Jane? How are you going to do that?
But you wrote it down. You still wrote it down.
I wrote it down. And it's here somewhere in the Dying Matters archives. I wrote it down and I remember thinking, oh, and I nearly tore it up. And then I thought, no, let it go. And here we are releasing a feature documentary with the voices of bereaved mothers, bereaved fathers and bereaved siblings all telling their stories in the Prince Charles Cinema in Leicester Square on the 18th of May. And I'm thinking, really? How on earth have we done this? We're not celebrities. We're ordinary people. We are really ordinary people. But what we represent as ordinary people are the ordinary people who have voice to speak on behalf of all the people who feel they can't talk about death, who've lost a child or a loved one, a partner, a husband, in an untimely way.
Yeah.
And in a way, I feel a sense of total commitment to all those people who feel they can't do what we do through making films and feel they can't speak or go on the radio. You know, it's never comfortable sharing your story, and part of me wants to keep Josh's life private. I don't want people knowing about it. He's our son. But the other part of me thinks by sharing our stories, it makes a difference.
Mm.
So all the contributors to our feature documentary, A Love That Never Dies, they're all sharing their children's stories. Not because they want to be in a film, because believe me, there's nothing fun about being in a film. It's because they want people to understand how lonely, how dreadful it can be to be bereaved.
Yeah.
And that they want to connect with other people. And they want other people to know that You don't get over it. You learn to live with it. And that's what our films are about.
Yeah. How did you, as we're on A Love That Never Dies, how did you go about explaining to people what you were doing and persuading people to be in this film? Were they people you knew?
No, it was really difficult because we decided that, you know, Josh was travelling when he died and that, you know, we would travel in his name, and we thought we would go to, we needed to go to an English speaking country because we couldn't have interpreters all the time. And we thought, we'd always dreamt of doing a road trip in America, and that was our last holiday with Josh. So through the Compassionate Friends, which is a huge peer-to-peer support group in the States and an amazing peer-to-peer support group in this country, both separate but based on the same peer-to-peer principle, we wrote to them, and through them in the States we were sent, 60 people wrote to us, all of whom we wrote back to, and we whittled it down and down and down. And, you know, yeah, we had amazing people from Alaska wanting us to go and film them, but actually we had to do a geographic route. We started in New York, we finished in San Francisco, so we had to plot it geographically. And we wanted it to be across class and race. That was an absolute priority for us, and we've done that. But that was a real challenge. You know, and every person who wrote to us saying they wanted to take part, we wrote back to. But of course, then when we whittled it down, as soon as we contacted the people, they'd say, oh, no, we don't think we can do it. We're scared. We don't. And we would say to them, we, like you, are bereaved parents. We're not going to exploit you. We're not going to, you know, share your story or distort your story. We want your voice to be heard, and we'd love you to take part. So they agreed. And they shared their stories with such remarkable courage around suicide, where on top of the death of your child, there's the stigma. One family told us that they'd been told, well, it's not so bad because he took his life. He didn't value his life enough. Other person would say, you know, well, you can have another child. You'll get over it. Everything happens for a reason. All the stories of things that you have to kind of pinch yourself to believe. But of course, nobody says it with ill intent, with mal intent. It's always well intentioned.
It's just cliches that we hear.
Yeah, about. And we reproduce when we're in panic.
Yeah.
And what do people say when they don't know what to say? They either say nothing or they say something that they really wish they hadn't said.
I don't think I know anyone who's been bereaved who has ever found everything happens for a reason a helpful thing to hear.
Well, interestingly enough, my GP said that to me when I went to see her after Josh had died, and I was beside myself and I didn't know what to do and I didn't know where to go. And I went to my GP and she said, how are you? And I said, my son's died and I don't know what to do, and I'm a therapist. And she said, everything happens for a reason. And I'm not going to tell you what I said. I'm not even going to go there. And I know she meant it. I know she meant it from a good place.
Yeah.
But frankly, in my state of mind, I could have wrestled with her.
Yeah.
We won't go there. But, and I'm not going to tell you what I said. But I soon realised that, you know, you're going to get used to that. You've got to get used to it, because the next few years were full of things like that.
Yeah. Do you think channeling your kind of grieving process into all these creative projects helped with that process of being or feeling more okay?
That's a really good question. What we discovered, and I suppose because we are fairly creative in the way that we've worked through our grief with photography and film and writing, it really helped. What didn't help was being in a dark room on your own. For us, grieving's about doing. And so what we've done is the Good Grief Project, we've set up retreats for bereaved parents where they can come and participate in creative writing, photography workshops, mindfulness, active grief. Men can walk along beside each other without looking at each other, and they can communicate in a way that's easier, and women too. But the point is that that creative process is so liberating, and it's hard to believe that. But doing as well. You know, in the early stages when I was just lost, running became a thing for me. I'd go running and I'd, at the end of each run, I would stop and I'd record my stories and my thoughts. So I'd go for a run thinking, I don't want to do this. I hate this. And I'd come back and I'd go, I feel so much better. And I'd record my thoughts from that run, and I made them into running stories, running thoughts, and they're on our website. It was really interesting. So I proved to myself in my least motivated moments that being active can help.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, so often that lack of motivation means that you just don't want to do anything. When you need it most, you want to do at least.
Yeah.
That's the problem. So the creative side, the creative writing, creating the website, gathering people's stories, it's about the idea that doing helps.
Mm.
A Love That Never Dies is premiering in the Prince Charles Cinema in Leicester Square on Friday the 18th of May during Dying Matters Week. You can buy your tickets now at www.princecharlescinema.com. You can also visit www.alovethatneverdiesfilm.com to find out if it's coming to a cinema near you during its tour this summer. If this conversation has got you thinking about what you want your funeral to look like, Dying Matters can help you work through the options. We have a leaflet called My Funeral Wishes, which includes a simple questionnaire that you can fill out with your preferences. Things like whether or not you want a theme, what colours you want guests to wear, and where you'd like everything to happen. We recommend filling in the form in the company of loved ones to start a conversation about your funeral and theirs. You can download it from the Dying Matters website, www.dyingmatters.org, or buy it in bulk from our shop at www.shop.hospiceuk.org. Jane has demonstrated that there are several options when it comes to planning a funeral, and that you don't have to stick to the traditional formula if it doesn't work for you. My next guest, Hasina Zaman, Director of Compassionate Funerals, lives by that philosophy as well. I talked to her about why she decided it was so important to set up a funeral business that could provide bespoke services capable of meeting the needs of London's diverse communities.
When I set it up, really, I mean, it sounds really bizarre when I look back, but this is the truth, is that I really didn't want to make a huge difference. I just wanted to do a little service about where I was going to support my family and then look after people and, you know, at a really tough time and that was it. You know, I just didn't really see like the work that we're doing now. I'd never had that vision. And you may think I'm naive, but I think also I was at a time where I was, you know, I was in my late 40s. And, I just thought I don't really need another career. I just need to have something where I am. I'm going to make a difference, but on a small scale. So I think that's what our vision was. And what that difference was, it was going to be like an individual basis, like family to family, making a real difference, making sure that they get a really good funeral, and not the funeral like I had from my sister-in-law who died from suicide and my mom who died from an instant heart attack. And it was, I'm from a Muslim background, so that funeral was really, really rushed, absolutely impersonal, zero level of care or even like concern for how we may be feeling emotionally. Mm-hmm. And I think I was so traumatized by it that I didn't deal with it until, I don't think I've actually still dealt with it, because it's still very, very painful when I think about my sister-in-law's death and then the funeral. There was so much humiliation and, I felt really, really persecuted by my community. And that sounds like a really strong word, but it was the feelings that I felt like we were somehow responsible for. And I know we are responsible as a community, but it was like that personally, I felt personally, you know, that we drove her to her death. And that really doesn't sit with me well. I'm not okay with it, and I'm going to be honest. And, you know, and even my mom, she died quite young. She was only in her late 40s. So I started compassionate funerals really the time she died. And I, you know, you have these things and you think, God, am I going to like live beyond the age of 48? Because my mom did. So you have, you know, death has this really interesting hold over you that you, and it almost it controls you until you think, hang on, where is this coming from? Unless you have like a real chat with it and say, like, what is this about, you know? And it is, they're true thoughts and feelings that can come and really overpower you and disempower you, I would say, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what does a compassionate funeral sort of look like? Like, how do you involve, is the family involved in the process?
Yeah, so, I mean, like, my favourite funeral that I like to lead, and I don't actually lead very many funerals, because, you know, we are getting bigger and we are expanding, is where the family actually leads the funeral. And I call that an empowered funeral. So, like, we lead from the back. So if it's paging the hearse, they'll either be at the front, or they will actually have quite a lot of decision-making process, which actually goes quite against when you arrange a funeral, because when you're arranging a funeral, you're actually pretty much telling the family, this is what you want, this is what you can have, in a roundabout way. That is the way the conversation goes. But I feel, and I can see now, that there's a real shift happening, and we're not the only ones who's doing it, because I can see it. There's a loads of, you know, especially women, girls on the block, you know, that have come out and doing their own funeral services, funeral, and they're saying, look, we're going to do it this way, because they're coming with feminine energy, they're coming with feminine attitude and feminine power, and it's a very, very different way of doing a funeral. And that way is like actually saying that we've got you, you can, this is a creative space, you can do the funeral you want, you know. So
in what way do you think it's different?
So I think it's much more fluid. It's less tangible. It's like saying, okay, what would you like? Rather than said, would you like this standard package? You know, and that's one thing that we don't do. We avoid doing packages. And I've had to really fight against, you know, because I have business people who do business consultancy with me. I pay for them. And they say, right, you must go for the package route. All businesses are doing that. And I just say, no, you know, we sit in the bespoke artisan space. And that means is that we are here to actually serve the family with their needs, with their wishes, and with their expectations. But if we are suddenly box everybody and say, okay, well, you can have this, and then maybe a little bit of personalization and meaning there. And we think, I think it's the wrong way of doing, I think it's the wrong way of doing business. And I think the right way of doing business is coming from the center of the needs of the client. And I think, I feel that there's and I can see there's a real big shift happening up and down the country where women are, and it is mainly, you know, women of white English middle class background who have that confidence to go out and say, well, actually I can have a go at this, you know. And they're doing it, and I feel like I'm part of that, you know, that little movement that's going on, or big movement, I'm not sure, because there's not that many of us, you know, comparative to the amount of funeral directors that there are. So there's some, you know, but waves being shaken.
Yeah, there's a group of people starting to redefine what a funeral sort of looks like. Because I think, you know, with weddings and stuff, we're kind of at the point now where we accept that all weddings will look different. But a funeral, there's still that stock kind of image or reel that we see in films or TV and stuff, where everything looks basically the same, right?
Yeah, right. You're right. And it is 100% right. So I think, again, it will, I feel like it will change, but it will take maybe another generation to do that. But the beauty of working in your own community is that you know people, and people know you, and they may be initially comfortable, but after, you know, especially if they've been to a funeral, it's uncomfortable for me. It is, I'm going to be, you know, hand on heart, it's uncomfortable for me when I have to do funerals for people I know. Like, I have one tomorrow, and it's going to be a big funeral, and I would say that probably 70% of the mourners I'm going to know. That's just it, you know, and it's uncomfortable, but it's like it. Then I say to myself, well, you signed up for this, and it's part of the deal. You've got to go through it. You've got to, you know, be there, deal with it.
And they trust you.
Yeah. And I think that's the main thing. It's the trust, isn't it? So we get calls, you know, absurd times. I get my Facebook, my Facebook iMessenger. I have to sort of use it. I have to keep it on top of it. It's like almost like an email for us or for me, because people do just call me and say, right, you know, this happened. Can you help? What's happened? You know, do you know what to do? And genuinely, people don't know what to do. That's the biggest thing that we are finding, that people don't know what to do, because it's actually quite natural in a way that people don't know what to do, because a lot of these people are doing funerals for the first time,
you know, they're people of my age, so they're doing funerals for their parents, and they are second generation in the UK. You know, they've not had that, you know, grandfather, great-grandfather, or their community. You know, they come, yeah. maybe come from quite a small community, so they don't have that extended family in the UK. And yeah, and more so with the, I would say, within the Eastern European community, it's much, much more tougher, because they not do they not and they're not they're actually first generation, you know. So that's, in a way, there's much more challenges.
Yeah. And what do you think, what is funeral provision like across the UK for people from minority communities? Like, are we able to meet their needs? Is it difficult to get, for people to get the kind of funeral that caters to their, you know, specific cultural or religious requirements?
I mean, I don't feel comfortable, confident talking about the whole across the country.
No, sure.
But I would say people struggle with getting their religious needs and cultural needs met. And there is a difference between the two.
Yeah.
You know, because we've done, you know, quite a few Hindu funerals now and Muslim funerals, and the same. And, like, you know, you think, like, we did some Sri Lankan funerals last year, and the actual funeral rite was amazingly beautiful. Like, it was so beautiful. And there's this whole ceremony that takes around the deceased. You know, they're in the coffin, they're just about to have the, like, 2 hours before they get to cremation. So the ceremony itself, it is so, so humbling, and it's so beautiful because there's lots of food involved, and grains and flowers and oils and spices and herbs, coconuts, and, you know, an amazing natural food from the earth involved. So, you know, you think that everything funeral's going to be like that. So you do another, you know, you take instruction for another Hindu funeral. Oh no, we're not going to do that part. We're going to do something different, and we just want this and we just want that. So again, I think what we're learning is that we can't actually make assumptions or make any prejudgments about what someone's going to want. I think it's just to always stay open and say, you know, and even like Rastafarian, we did some Rastafarian funerals last year, and even that was very, very different, you know. So again, it's just each really taking each family as they come. But I suppose what is giving us is that level of confidence to say that, yeah, we've done Rastafarian funerals, and we've done funerals, you know, we've done humanist funerals, atheist funerals,
So can I run a hypothetical by you?
Of course, yeah.
So I talked to my mum about funerals, and she said, I want a Viking funeral. And I was like, okay. And I don't know that we'd be allowed to do that properly. But, like, say I came to you with that, and it's like, I know this is what my mum wanted. I've no idea how practical or feasible, or even if this could be a thing. Like, how would you sort of...
Yeah, so brilliant question. And what I would say to your mum, that we would be able to do part Viking funeral, because it's to do with cremation laws. Or did you want to be cremated or buried?
I imagine cremated. Because
part of the Viking funeral rites is that you start to get cremated on the actual Viking boat. So in the UK, that can't happen. So that part of the ceremony can't happen.
Yeah.
But you can actually have a part Viking. So you can have your coffin, you know, go onto a boat and have the Viking rites read out and the ceremony done. Yeah, so what I would say to, yeah, we can do it part. And it's really important to explore that. So what would that look like? And what, you know, what part of the waterways or river does she want to go into? Where does that want to be? So having that conversation, she'd go back to her and say, actually, you know, let's discuss this even further.
So, as you can hear, I've got some homework. For what it's worth, I would never have guessed that my mum would want a Viking funeral if we hadn't happened to have that conversation. It's valuable knowledge. And thanks to Hasina, I now know that there are avenues we can pursue to make it happen. It is so worth having that conversation with your family and finding out these things. You just might be surprised. Thank you so much to my guests this week, Jane Harris and Hasina Zaman, and special thanks also to the amazing Bernadette Ryan for our theme music. Dying Matters is a part of Hospice UK, the national charity for hospice and palliative care. If you enjoyed our podcast, make sure you rate and review us on the iTunes store so that we can reach even more people and get everyone talking. What kind of funeral do you want to have? Tell us by getting in touch on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Dying Matters.